The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with the assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Greetings and a very big welcome to today's episode of Climate Matters. I'm Lindsay Wood, the Director of Climate Strategy Company Resilience, and Climate Matters is brought to you by Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. It's also broadcast on Plains Media to listeners in Canterbury and to the Wairarapa on Arrow FM. Well, today we have a special episode. It's the first of our considerable series on front-footing the future, and with interviews of a whole range of experts ahead of the general elections later this year. Today, we're starting with the first one with Professor Jonathan Boston, who will no doubt impress you with his detailed knowledge, not only of policy generally, but of climate policy in particular. It's a full interview. I do hope you get a lot out of it. And just by way of introduction, purely by coincidence, in a couple of weeks' time, Jonathan has a book being published called Ensuring the Future, which fits well with our Front Footing the Future series. It comes out in June. Look out for that. It's a very good read. Anyway, here's the interview with Jonathan. It's a special pleasure to welcome Professor Jonathan Boston to Climate Matters. Jonathan is now semi-retired from his role as Professor of Policy Studies at the School of Government at Victoria University. He's been closely involved with several important policy initiatives, has written widely on climate change policy, and in 2021 was appointed an Officer of the New Zealand Order of Merit for services to public policy and social policy. I can't think of anyone better to open our pre-election series on climate policy. A warm welcome, Jonathan. I'm greatly looking forward to our conversation.
Well, likewise, Lindsay, thank you very much. And thank you for this opportunity. I'm delighted to participate in this conversation. Thank you.
I want to kick off, Jonathan, with a bit of a helicopter view on climate policy. One of the truisms about the climate crisis is that climate issues are connected to everything. And another is that we're heading into uncharted territory. And I don't think that's often talked about, but humans have never, ever lived in the global climate we're now experiencing, let alone where we're heading. Can you please unpick for listeners the policy implications of those perspectives? And if possible, give us an overview of how you consider climate policy should best be structured to serve the people of New Zealand.
Well, Lindsay, this is a vast topic, kind of affects almost everything. And we need to start probably at the global level. It's essentially a problem of the atmosphere being a potential dumping ground for all our greenhouse gas emissions, essentially individuals, businesses, and countries, free ride, and pump greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. It's in everyone's interest, actually, that we avoid doing that because of changing the climate system on the planet with all the risks and costs that entails. And so over the last 30, 40 years or so, we've tried globally to put in place a multilateral process through the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change to try and address this global collective action problem and thus mitigate the challenge by reducing the amount of greenhouse gases we're pumping into the atmosphere and thus avoiding extremely damaging, if not catastrophic, climate change. But the next thing is that, unfortunately, climate change exhibits a variety of attributes that make it a very, very complex problem to deal with at the national level. And let me just quickly highlight what I mean. So what are called wicked problems and tame problems. There are long problems and slow problems. There are messy problems and simple problems and so on. In the case [S2] Yes. [S1] Of climate change, we have simultaneously a problem that covers multiple really difficult problem types. And without spending too much time on all this, just let me mention a few aspects of this that highlight why this is such a problem from a policy point of view. A creeping problem is one that sort of develops slowly, in which in the early stages, there typically are very few what you might call early warning signals or focusing events that draw attention to the problem and therefore require urgent action by politicians. So creeping problems take many forms. You can think of the onset of obesity. You can think about the slow growth of toxic substances in a waterway or whatever. Well, climate change is like that. You can go for decades, really, without realizing that you're changing things significantly and that there are more and more risks downstream, so to speak. And so dealing with creeping problems politically is very difficult because it's very difficult to mobilize people to act and very difficult to mobilize politicians to act on people's problem. And a long problem has at least two key characteristics. One, it's persistent and durable. And second, there's a big gap between the causes and the full or final effects. And where you have a very big gap between causation and consequence, again, politically, it's very difficult to mobilize early action, precautionary action to mitigate the problem. Finally, just to note, climate change is a wicked problem. Wicked problems are essentially problems where there's no easy solution and that every solution that's available has costs and downsides. And climate change is like that. There are ways in which we can reduce emissions, but they're all problematic in various ways, and they're all contested politically. And not only is, unfortunately, not only is climate change a wicked problem, but it's also been classified as a super wicked problem. And that is because it has three additional characteristics above and beyond wicked problems. And very quickly, they are, first, that time is running out. And we know that, obviously, in relation to climate change. Secondly, those who are contributing most to the problem have the least incentive, kind of economically, to ameliorate the problem. So you think about the people who generate the most emissions, the wealthy people on the planet. They have the least incentive to do something about it because they feel themselves to be immune and they can buy themselves out of problems. And the third problem is that there's no central coordinating and enforcement mechanism globally that can really ensure that the problem is dealt with efficiently, fairly, and expeditiously. The UN can coordinate, but it can't impose sanctions and enforce decisions. It's an incredibly risky problem in the sense that we're dealing with a problem where there is the potential for absolutely catastrophic impacts. So for all those sorts of reasons, addressing climate change is really challenging at multiple levels, whether it's international, national, subnational, for individual businesses and indeed for individuals and whānau. So we have to recognize, if we're going to make any progress at all in this space, that we are dealing with a really unique and unprecedented issue. If we don't recognize that, then we're really starting on very insecure and inappropriate foundations.
Picking up on what you said right at the end there, about having good foundations to base our way forward. Do you have any sort of summative comments about what a government in New Zealand, say, might be, where it might be setting its sights on climate policy to try and engage effectively with that sort of thing?
So as you would know, Lindsay, and I'm sure your listeners will be aware, I mean, there's two fundamental types of challenge that we face with climate change. One is mitigation, that is reducing the volume of greenhouse gases that we are pumping into the atmosphere. And the second is adapting to the consequences of climate change. So if we're going to make progress, we have to both mitigate globally and locally and adapt globally and locally. And both pose multiple policy challenges. If you want my take on what we should be doing, well, at the global level, we should be seeking to minimize the amount of warming that we generate. The international community 10 years ago in Paris agreed on certain guardrails, temperature guardrails for the planet, and basically said we want to ensure that we avoid much more than 1.5 degrees warming above pre-industrial. On the basis of the available science, certainly that I've read, there is every reason to believe that the more warming we have, the more risks we have of triggering particular critical tipping points in the Earth system, which include things like irreversible melting of the West Antarctic ice sheet. And what we know now that we didn't know perhaps so well 30 years ago is that the tipping points for these systems are at lower temperature thresholds than was previously thought. So in fact, when I got involved in climate change policy issues 20 years ago, the broad consensus among the scientific within the scientific community was that we probably wouldn't cross any critical tipping point until towards 3 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial. And that view has changed significantly.
Absolutely.
So going back to the sort of the global point, we need to minimize the amount of warming we have, and wherever we stop warming, be it somewhere between whatever 1.5, which we're bound to cross, and say 2.5 or whatever, we then need to begin the process of cooling the planet, and doing so as expeditiously and as cost effectively as we can. And the warmer we warm the planet, the more difficult it is going to be to cool the planet. And a lot of people don't seem to understand the magnitude of the risks entailed there. On the adaptation side of things, very quickly, I mean, the key goal, really, it seems to me, is that we need to enhance and maximize societal resilience to the ongoing accelerating impacts of climate change. And those impacts, as people will be aware, have multiple forms. They include more severe flooding, more powerful storms, stronger winds, more severe fire, more severe drought, and perhaps the biggest, particularly for a country like New Zealand with a very long coastline, will be accelerating sea level rise. And that means, among other things, we're going to have to move large numbers of people out of harm's way.
If you're reading a political party manifesto over the next few months, do you have a picture of, oh, this is where I'd like some policy settings to be heading in that space?
For most people, the biggest impact is going to be on their on what they own, their properties, yes. Houses, cars, and so on, and the increasing risk of damage from sea level rise, from more severe flooding, from more severe winds. Climate change is exacerbating the ongoing weather events that we have. Now, one of the immediate effects of that for all homeowners, of course, is that insurance costs are going up. In my case, our home and contents insurance has gone from roughly $2,000 a year 4 years ago to $8,000, so a fourfold increase. At a national level, the average cost of household insurance in real terms, more than four times. So we're seeing the early signs, yes, of insurance retreat. So coming to your question, what should we be doing at the sort of policy level? Well, look, very briefly, it seems to me we need an integrated, systematic, holistic sort of approach to this. There's no one right, simple solution. We need to do our very best to avoid additional risks. So that means stopping building in areas that are likely to be flood-prone, prone to landslips or fire and other hazards over the coming decades and beyond. Thirdly, we need to reduce existing risk. And we can do that in a variety of ways. One of them is to invest in cost-effective additional protection for properties. That might be improving stop banks or seawalls that will protect properties. So in many, many cases where properties are going to be vulnerable to accelerating sea level rise, we are going to have to, in my view, have a policy in place which entails and enables planned relocation to occur, so that vulnerable properties are moved out of harm's way, ideally before they're damaged, and certainly before they're damaged multiple times. Yes. And this is going to be politically very difficult. So coming to your point about, well, what should be in manifestos, Lindsay, I think we need, and these are complex matters, but very briefly, we need to rethink our insurance arrangements so that we can ensure affordable and available insurance, but in the context of a wider kind of transformative adaptation strategy. And in particular, I think we need to establish funding mechanisms both for protection, but in particular for planned relocation, which is going to become increasingly needful over coming decades. And if we simply take the view that this is a problem for property owners and we can just leave it to them to cope with the unprecedented risks that they're going to face, well, I think that would be absolutely disastrous. It would be morally repugnant because people will be suffering all manner of harms unnecessarily. Yeah. It will be economically irresponsible because we will be less resilient as a society and as an economy if we simply leave it to individuals to cope. And it will have all manner of undesirable social consequences. Basically, in terms of manifestos for the 2026 general election, on the adaptation side of things, in a nutshell, I'd want to see commitments to rethinking our overall insurance arrangements and funding arrangements for transformative adaptation over the coming decades and beyond. Recognizing, I appreciate all this is going to be really difficult. This is not simple policy territory, and there are many trade-offs and complications.
Because it seems to me that there's some pretty big writing on the wall as to where that's heading under climate change. And I know last year there was an article by Gunther Tullinger, who's a director of the very big insurance company Allianz, in which he described entire regional economies suddenly becoming kneecapped by becoming uninsurable. Can you give listeners a sense of what macro-scale insurance might look like in the future?
So look, let's start at the global level. There is a range of data from the big insurance companies of the kind that you've mentioned, along with the reinsurance companies like Munich Re and Swiss Re and so on. What we know very quickly is that insurance losses globally are running in the vicinity of 300, 400 billion US per annum. And most of that is due to weather-related events. And that's partly because we haven't had really big damaging earthquakes globally for a while. Now, that's just insurance losses or costs. Economic costs are multiples of that because lots of people, of course, aren't insured. And there are also multiple ripple effects of big climate-related events.
Absolutely.
So what we also know is that the cost of damage from sort of weather-related events is going up quite rapidly. The increase is around 6% per annum, whereas global GDP is going up at about 3% per annum. So if one cost is going up far more, like double the rate of the other, you're going to have a problem. So what will happen almost certainly is over time, we will see insurers pulling back. And one of the things about insurance, which is really important for people to understand, is that most contracts are annual. So insurers can literally pull the plug at the end of the contract period. And if people can't secure insurance from somewhere else, well, then they become uninsured. And that's the case for homeowners. It's the case for businesses and anyone else who's wanting to insure properties or crops or whatever it might be. So there's a lot of property at stake, and the impacts of climate change will impact across the full range. Overall consequences for society will mean, in effect, we become less resilient because we'll have less insurance to kick in when the big disasters strike, and more people will face larger losses. Recovery will take longer. There will be more severe economic consequences, more unemployment, and so on. Basically, we need to be rethinking our current models of property insurance to take into account fully the unprecedented sort of circumstances that we now face and which are going to intensify over time, as I've indicated.
Both local and central government habitually retreats into the position that if you do what's really needed, you won't get re-elected. And that seems to me to be a very fatalistic approach that I'd love to find a way of breaking out of that in a way that we could put in the policies we need in a way that actually sticks. I'd love to hear what you have to say on that dilemma.
So, as I sort of indicated right at the beginning, Lindsay, we're dealing with an unprecedented kind of policy problem. There's no simple fix trying to get either multi-party or at least bipartisan agreement across the two main parties on our core sort of mitigation strategy and our core adaptation strategy. We managed to do that, and we got the zero carbon bill through. And I thought we had then achieved, you know, something of a breakthrough. But unfortunately, the National Party and its dealings with New Zealand First and ACT in forming the current government, it gave away some really significant policy goals in relation to climate change, particularly in the mitigation space. So we've been going backwards on the mitigation side now for the last 2.5 years in a way that I find very distressing personally. So my, I guess what I think here is that New Zealand First and ACT might be beyond the pale in the sense that they're not going to really take climate change seriously until it's far too late. And it may be far too late now, but anyway, they're simply willfully blind and politically short-termist in their orientation rather than really thinking what's in the long-term national interest, what's in the interest of humanity over the long haul. And that's very, very sad. And I find it just incredibly disconcerting and disappointing. But the National Party has within it people who do take climate change very seriously. And I think we should try and get another deal, essentially, between Labour and National. We need political leaders to be speaking the truth about climate change repeatedly.
Well said.
And sadly, you know, we've had a situation in which political leaders really across the political spectrum, but particularly on the centre-right, have simply not been willing to talk truthfully about the seriousness of the climate change challenges we face and give proper attention to the overwhelming consensus within the science community about the risks. We really got to have leaders who are willing to speak publicly, regularly, and truthfully and lay it out. So that people understand what is at stake. Then I think we need to think very carefully about how we frame the issues we face from a public communication point of view and how we mobilize public concern. So a communication strategy, and then that would, among other things, need to focus particularly on the co-benefits of action to highlight that, you know, we're not just talking about climate change here. We're talking about energy security issues. We're talking about better health for people. We're talking about a more resilient future. We live in a world in which dreadful things happen. And we have to take the reality of evil and suffering and disappointment and disagreement, you know, very seriously. And I suppose there's two things just therefore that come out of all that. The first would be that we are going to have to, as a society, cope with extraordinary losses over the coming decades and beyond. These are losses that will have profound impacts on us as people, emotional, psychological, economic, and much else, spiritual, if people are willing to use that category, and so on. And if we're going to cope as a society, we're going to have to talk honestly and openly about how we manage those losses. And this is going to be very difficult. And then the second thing would be this. If you read the science, things are going to get worse. We don't want false hope. My point there would be that many of the things that you and I and many others do at the moment appear to be having virtually no impact. You know, we're going backwards from a policy point of view in New Zealand. Look what's happening in the US. And I suppose my point here would be we need, as human beings, as people who have a responsibility to be ethically responsible, to continue doing what we're doing. We need to act even in the context that we have a sense that very little of what we do actually will make much difference because doing the right thing is the right thing.
That's a very human note to finish on. Thank you. I do want to thank you for being so generous, both with your time and with your expertise. We're very lucky to have you join the program, and particularly at the front end of it. So a big thank you from me, Jonathan, for joining us.
Well, can I say thank you, Lindsay, for all that you've been doing over many, many years in this space. I greatly appreciate that, as I'm sure many many others do across the communities that you interact with. So thank you, Lindsay, and all the very best.
Very kind. Thanks, Jonathan. Well, how good was that? And that's just the first of over almost 20 interviews we'll be bringing you in the Front Footing the Future series on climate policy. The next week will be Professor James Renwick, well known to many on Radio New Zealand, a former lead author with the IPCC, a former commissioner on the Climate Change Commission. The week after that will be Dr. Mike Joy, well known as a freshwater ecologist, but also for his very wide boundary thinking on climate. So do keep in touch with us. I do hope I enjoy your company again next week. And of course, kia kaha for the climate. Well, as you know, you're listening to Fresh FM, the top of the South's community access radio station. Fresh FM broadcasts in Blenheim on 88.9, to Eastern Golden Bay on 95.0, to the Nelson CBD on 107.2, and across the Nelson Tasman region on 104.8. It's also streamed to the planet on freshfm.co.nz, and podcasts of Climate Matters and of other locally produced shows are available through freshfm.co.nz.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.co.nz, for our contact details.